A move by publisher Penguin to thaw out relations with libraries is seen as cold comfort by some. And in reviews, we head to the stars with UC Santa Barbara historian W. Patrick McCrae, whose latest book sees the 60s-era enthusiasm for space exploration as an antidote to the Cold War and fears of nuclear annihilation. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of the news that has everyone in publishing talking. And joining me from PW's New York office is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor, as usual. Welcome back, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So it seems as if... you know, J.K. Rowling just can't catch a break. She's doing a great job selling books, but some people just aren't even happy with that.
Yeah. You know, despite some lukewarm kind of nasty reviews, I'm not feeling too bad for J.K. Rowling. You know, I don't know what to make of the reaction that she's been getting to her book, The Casual Vacancy. Part of me thinks the reviewers are being kind of unfair to her. And a lot of people I know and trust say that they are very much enjoying the book. And you know, I'm kind of also surprised with the low profile marketing campaign here. Little Brown seemed to be working harder than Mitt Romney before the debate to lower expectations for this book. But, you know, let's face it, nothing was going to lower expectations here, fair or unfair, because this is best-selling author in the world, J.K. Rowling. But by the numbers, which we will have in Monday's issue, she's actually doing pretty well. So in Monday's issue, we'll have a pretty detailed report on how Rowling stacked up. And the fact is, she did actually very well. She was the number one bestseller for the week ending September 30th. She beat out 50 Shades of Grey, which was number two, and No Easy Day, the Navy SEAL Bin Laden book, which was number three. Notably, we don't really know. I believe we don't know at this time what the ebook sales were. Little Brown did not release them. But, you know, we may know them next week. And anyway, you can look for the full report in Monday's issue.
Well, you know, for my taste, anything that knocks 50 Shades of Grey down a peg is not a bad thing. And in our weekly scorecard of the ebook story, there's more news and some fallout from the library world.
Yeah, so in the timing is everything department, this week vendor 3M announced that its library ebook pilot with Penguin has gone live. Now, you'll remember that this program was announced just after the ALA annual meeting in Anaheim in June, and it comes after Penguin ditched Overdrive, the big library ebook vendor, at the end of 2011, upset over Overdrive's deal with Amazon to facilitate lending to the Kindle. Now, the launch of the 3M Penguin project generated some headlines, and that kind of offered the appearance of progress on the ebook issue, especially after last week's much hyped meeting between publishers and ALA at the AAP offices here in New York. But I'm here to curb your enthusiasm. There's really not much progress there with this pilot project, if any. And here's why. If there was any news really to come out of this, is that the program, while finally launching, actually launched a month later than it was expected to. And second, despite a 3M release saying that Penguin ebooks could soon be available to libraries nationwide by the end of the year, we have no indication that that's actually going to happen. We reached out to Penguin, and they haven't confirmed or even commented on what might actually happen with ebooks by the end of the year. So for now, we're sticking with the story that it's just going to be a pilot project with New York Public Library and Brooklyn Public Library. But more importantly, this 3M Penguin program is still really very restrictive. For example, it windows new books, holding them from libraries for 6 months after publication. Once they become available, libraries can then only get them on a one-year license. Now, think about that for a second. HarperCollins, which instituted a 26-lend limit last year by comparisons, will let you keep that book on your shelf until you hit, you know, your number of lends, no matter how many years it takes. For Penguin, if you buy access to a book and you only lend it four times, you have to license that again if you get demand after a year. Or, you know, you don't have to license it again, but then you risk disappointing your users. That's not a terribly good deal for libraries. And really what it does is create a lot of work for libraries in sort of managing their budgets and collections. But for me, here's the real rub right now as I see it, that Penguin is exclusive to vendor 3M in the ebook market, and that raises the specter to libraries of having to sign up with multiple vendors to get different content from different publishers. Now, if that world comes to pass, it would really add an administrative burden to libraries and also for patrons, because how many plugins can we expect library patrons to download just to start checking out books from their library? You know, and right now, 3M says it's only in 70 libraries. Overdrive, on the other hand, has, you know, claims it has 18,000 network library partners. 18,000 versus 70, a bit of a disparity there. So you have to wonder how many libraries are going to add a new vendor like 3M, even though they work with 3M in a lot of ways, but how many are going to want to add another ebook vendor just to get, you know, a certain publisher's content? Now, I might also add here that we're seeing this problem of exclusivity rear its head on the consumer side, too. This week, as you may know, Barnes & Noble refused to sell Hollywood director Penny Marshall's autobiography, which was published by, you guessed it, Amazon. So we're seeing this battle of platforms emerge, and readers are increasingly being caught in the middle. Now, on the library side, don't get me wrong, I think competition in the e-lending space is very good and, frankly, essential. And I know that libraries are really eager to have more options when it comes to this, but I'm really kind of fearful that these kind of exclusives are going to become popular, and I don't think that they're very good for readers.
So it's your view, Andrew, and I know this is a subject that you really care pretty deeply about, you know, access to ebooks via public libraries. You see it as something of an impasse at the moment.
I do. You know, I really don't think that there's much progress here, and I can't even say at this point that there is a lot of hope for progress in the near future. You know, going back to some of the coverage of the ALA-AAP meeting in New York last week, it was reported in some outlets that one of the questions asked by a publisher was, what's a library? And that generated a lot of blowback from librarians online and in my email inbox. But I was there, and I want to point out that I think that comment was kind of, you know, wasn't reported quite right. Yes, that question was asked, but the way it was reported made the question seem, you know, infuriatingly naive, and indeed some librarians were infuriated. But what the questioner was asking was a very real, deep question about things like consortial sales, and in the digital age, what's the role of the library? And that's really a valid question, because traditionally you had local libraries who were all buying copies of books for their communities. Now, with digital, ebook files can be stored centrally and distributed anywhere. Geography is not really an issue. So rather than selling to lots of small libraries all over the country, pubs can now sell to large publishers can now sell to large statewide consortiums. And, you know, let them do the distribution. Now, publisher concerns are that someone in Minnesota is going to be sitting on their couch with their e-reader and browsing books from a library that's 100 miles away, and that's going to hurt the local book sales. I don't think that's a terribly serious problem, and something that I do think it's something that we can deal with and overcome. But it's certainly part of the tension here and part of the discussion. So that question, what is a library, is actually a pretty central question to the discussion that I think we really need to be having. Now, what also wasn't reported there, and what I think is critical, is that I think ALA missed the opportunity to take that question and frame the way that publishers are actually trying to change the rules of the game. You know, and what I mean is this. In the past, when you published a book, you had very little control over that book once it was purchased. You know, you buy a book, you own the books you buy. Those books can be collected and lent and resold and passed on. You can, you know, use it to level furniture. Books can be banned or burned. They can be used to start revolutions. You know, and for all the occasional tension that caused, that system pretty much worked. I don't think there's any question that the system we've had has led to the greatest period of enrichment in the history of the world, and that libraries have been key in building a reading culture, indeed the reading culture that these large companies are now trading on. And I think in our libraries, we very effectively balance a desire to support authors and readers and business, and yet to promote learning and progress. Now, in the ebook world, publishers, and more specifically, big multinational corporations, because we're not talking about, you know, Alfred Knopf or Barney Rossett here anymore, they're attempting to use licenses in the ebook world in this fear of piracy to assert a level of control over literature that they've never previously had. They are trying to assert control over what you can do with the book after you buy it, because when you buy an ebook, you can't give it away, you can't lend it, you can't share it, you can't copy a page. And if you believe that most reading one day is going to be digital, that's disturbing. It's disturbing to think that big companies are going to be able to control the flow of ideas and culture like that. So whatever respect you have for publishers, and I, of course, this is my industry, I have great respect for them. But for these big multinational corporations, you know, it's kind of the shareholders that matter most here. And this is one reason why I'm so eager to see this ebook issue truly solved, because anyone who thinks that we should walk away from such a vital cultural institution as the public library and put our information and cultural future into the hands of Bertelsmann or Holzbrinck or Murdoch or Amazon, I think you need to really consider the consequences of that.
Well, indeed, all very thoughtful commentary, Andrew Albanese from Publishers Weekly. And you know, your concerns about those various players, you get to meet many of them coming up next week. You're going off to Frankfurt.
I'm off to Frankfurt, and I know that we'll address a lot of these issues while we're there. And I'm always amazed, especially in the last few years, while digital has become a real big part of the Frankfurt Book Fair, at the creativity and the innovation that I see there. So I'm really looking forward to jumping on a plane and spending a week in Germany with the international publishing community.
And we'll be chatting with you from the floor next week. And we certainly hope that those German air traffic controllers stay on the job and get you there in time. Andrew Albanese, features editor and senior writer at Publishers Weekly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now I want to turn to Samuel R. Slayton, reviews editor at Publishers Weekly. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Sam. Great to have you back.
It's good to be back, Chris.
And this week we start off the review of the reviews with a couple of boxed fiction reviews. One, if it's not a tragedy, at least it has some rather dark and somber themes. The other is much more lighthearted. It's a comedy.
That's right. The first one is English writer Jojo Moyes' return with Me Before You, an engrossing and disarmingly moving love story about a woman named Louisa who, at 26, is living a dully content life in her small English town. She works at the local cafe, and she's had the same boyfriend for 6 years. But when the cafe closes, the only job Louisa can get is caring for Will, a quote powerhouse of a man who was recently paralyzed in an auto accident. Will's frustration with his quadriplegia makes Louisa's job almost unbearable, but she perseveres in order to provide for her struggling family. When Louisa learns that Will intends to end his own life, she makes it her mission to convince him that life is still worth living. We called it a lovely novel, both non-traditional and enthralling. New Yorker humorist and former advertising copywriter John Kinney's debut novel, Truth in Advertising, is a hilarious ad world satire and modest family drama about Finn Dolan, whose advertising career is the only success of his life. We think that the advertising insider lore and commercial shoot set pieces are golden, but the family drama is less successful. As a satire, the novel seems willing to bite off an ambitious chunk of popular culture, but as a human drama, it chooses to make safe, modest choices. Even still, much of the book is a comic tour de force, recalling the works of Nick Hornby and Jonathan Tropper.
And Sam, in mystery and thriller, we've got something that takes us back to the Tudor era in England and the plight of English Jews.
That's right. Priscilla Royal highlights the plight of English Jews under Edward I in The Sanctity of Hate, her ninth medieval mystery and the best so far in the series. The murder of a man hired to protect some traveling Jews leads to suspicions that the Jews were responsible, but the local coroner believes that the order of the injuries and the reasons for them point elsewhere. Mark Douglas Home introduces a detective with a highly unusual profession in The Sea Detective. Cal McGill assists environmental groups by using wind speed and ocean current data to backtrack pollution to its source. He also tracks corpses, like that of a 13-year-old Indian girl who was sold into prostitution by her parents and later dumped in the ocean. McGill is a nicely understated hero, and it augurs well for a sustained series. We've also, in the mystery and thriller department, got a Q&A with Julie Rivett, Dashiell Hammett's granddaughter, who provides background material for Return of the Thin Man, a volume that collects two Hammett screen stories.
And in science fiction, Sam, what do we got?
We have a spinoff of an Ernest Hemingway novel, though I believe only in title. Mark Hodder's A Red Sun Also Rises is a loving homage to the 19th century novel with the barest tweaks for a 21st century sensibility, perfectly capturing the device of the narrator's diary with a handoff to present-day editor, natural philosophy preoccupations, and the struggle between divine and scientific views of creation. Hunchback Clarissa Stark and tormented minister Aidan Fleischer escape scandal by becoming missionaries, only to be assigned to an island of suspected cannibals. They learn the real reason for the inhabitants' disappearances when a sacrificial ritual transports them to another planet. The pacing is as vintage as the vividly imagined grotesqueries of alien life, but the rewards for acclimating to the style are well worth the effort. We also have a review of Howard Andrew Jones's The Bones of the Old Ones. It's the rousing sequel to The Desert of Souls and offers a melange of ancient adventure myths populated by convincing and endearing characters. In the 8th century CE, a period of frequent armed clashes between Byzantine Greeks and the Muslim Caliphate, tough Captain Asim el Abbas and scholar Dabir ibn Khalil rescue alluring and aristocratic Najah Binta Alima from her kidnappers, the Sabiti, a group of seven sinister supernatural wizards from the remote past. In Asim and Dabir's subsequent quest to find and destroy the ancient and powerful bone weapons, which are also being sought by the Sabiti, and free Najah from the weapon's soul-threatening spell, the friends experience one fearful ordeal after another, while brave Asim falls more and more for Najah's wit, courage, and charms. As intricately woven as the magic carpet of Greek sorceress Lydia, Jones's tale incorporates real historical personages and settings and fills the pages with gallantry and glamour to provide a thrilling spectacle.
And in the romance section, Sam, we've got two solid romantic thrillers.
Bestseller Mary Burton is back and delivers an action-packed tension as a cold case becomes new again in The Seventh Victim. Laura Church barely survived an attack by the Seattle Strangler. And 7 years later, she settled at her inherited family home in Austin, Texas, where she teaches photography at a university. When the Strangler returns, Texas Ranger James Beck interviews Laura, but she still can't remember anything about the attack. More women are strangled as the anniversary date of Laura's narrow escape looms. The blooming love interest between Beck and Laura, the number of red herring suspects, and the backstory on the victims make this a compelling romantic thriller. Melinda Lee follows last year's She Can Run with She Can Tell, in which relentless tension builds to a riveting crescendo. Farmer Rachel Parker challenges her abusive brother-in-law, and just as the blowhard lands a direct hit to Rachel's face, small-town police chief Mike O'Connell comes to the rescue. But the injury is the least of Rachel's problems. Somebody is trying to drive her off the family farm that she's only recently returned to. And as the threats escalate from graffiti to murder attempts, Mike decides he must protect Rachel 24/7. A subplot involving local graft and corruption intensifies the conflict, and Lee easily juggles multiple storylines, romance, and suspense.
For nonfiction, there are a few Q&As with some very prominent writers.
We talked to former Knopf and New York editor-in-chief Robert Gottlieb about his new book, Great Expectations, The Sons and Daughters of Charles Dickens, which we mentioned in last week's review of the reviews. And we also spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, Jared Diamond, about his new book, The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? We've also got some really great reviews in next week's issue. We've got a starred review of W. Patrick McCrae's The Visioneers, how a group of elite scientists pursued space colonies, nanotechnologies, and a limitless future. Here, McCrae profiles the larger-than-life characters that changed science and technology in the second half of the 20th century and beyond. At the center of this story is physicist Gerard O'Neill, whose rigorously realistic designs for space habitats, along with his optimistic dream of regular humans living and working in space, were a vivid antidote to, quote, the widespread pessimism surrounding the end of the Vietnam War, growing stockpiles of nuclear weapons, and environmental concerns. This is great nonfiction for sci-fi fans. And another spacey title starts on firmer ground, but has some compelling intergalactic implications. University of Chicago paleontologist Neil Shubin wrote about the fishy origins of humanity in 2009's Your Inner Fish. In his new book, The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets, and People, he goes farther back and further out, explaining how glints in Greenlandic rocks and spreading signs of supernova reveal, quote, deep ties to the forces that shaped our bodies. Shubin is a leading proponent of the fusion of paleontology, developmental genetics, and genomics, and the result of his efforts is a volume of truly inspired science writing. Appropriately vast in scope, Shubin deftly balances breadth and depth in his search for, quote, a sublimely beautiful truth. We also have a review of Nicholas Rowe's sumptuously written new biography of John Keats, entitled, appropriately, John Keats, A New Life. In this book, he reveals John Keats's short life. He died in 1821 at the age of 25 to have had considerable substance. The University of St. Andrews English professor vividly depicts the revolutionary era in which Keats lived, the liberal education that shaped his thinking, and the events that sensitized him to life's beauty and sadness. Poetic in its own right, this book is a masterly study of its subject. In Timeless Vietnam, a collection of nearly 100 photographs shot in present-day Vietnam, Khan Tang aims to look past the grisly wars of the last century by focusing on the unchanged daily lives of rice farmers reaping the fields, fishermen casting nets on the water, artisans in workshops, and others, stressing how deeply rooted these lives are in a cultural heritage, quote, undiminished by strife or modernism. In the foreword, folk musician Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary calls the photos, quote, celebrations of the beauty and the spirit that have nurtured and sustained the people of Vietnam in times of painful struggle, in times of peace. Following the recent publication of their massive tome, The Art Museum, Faden offers another gargantuan marvel that could easily double as its own coffee table. 20th century world architecture, the Faden Atlas, focuses on a truly global selection of buildings constructed during the 20th century. Organized by continent like a standard atlas, within each section, buildings are categorized into 13 different typologies, and keys for each region show which types predominate. Maps of trade flow and architect migration over the course of the century show how design talents move towards money or away from political strife. With over 5,000 images, this is easily in the running for most engrossing coffee table book of all time, or it will at least take up all of your time to flip through. Now, we all know that John Wilkes Booth succeeded in 1865, but the first major plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln unfolded in 1861 in anticipation of the then-president-elect's railway trip to Washington, D.C. In The Hour of Peril, Daniel Stashower explains how Alan Pinkerton, a temperamental Scottish cooper turned, quote, fierce and incorruptible lawman and founder of the Pinkerton Agency, sought to infiltrate and obfuscate a murderous group led by Cipriano Ferrandini, an outspoken Italian barber in Baltimore. Interweaving the tale of Pinkerton and company's efforts to foil the Baltimore plot with a rich portrait of a resolute but weary Lincoln making his way, both politically and physically, to the White House, this enthralling page-turner will please true crime, thriller, and history fans.
Well, you know, Sam, I recall that particular episode from my own history, and I remember there were rumors of Lincoln traveling in disguise. I might want to check that out to see whether those rumors are true. And finally, in children's books, we turn to a haunted White House where somebody meets the ghost of Abraham Lincoln.
That's right. We have a picture book review of Abe Lincoln's Dream by Lane Smith, in which a girl meets Lincoln's ghost on a tour of the White House and helps catch him up on the history that he's missed. Are the states united? He asks her. Did that work out? The book's engraving-style artwork and typography takes its cues from American currency, and Smith makes American history anything but dry, which won't come as any surprise to fans of his earlier books like It's a Book and The Big Elephant in the Room. Incidentally, this isn't the first time Smith has delved into political territory in his picture books. In 2008, just in time for the last presidential election, he offered Madame President about a young girl's dreams of higher office. And in 2006, he profiled a few of the founding fathers in John, Paul, George, and Ben. Now, that would be Hancock, Revere, Washington, and Franklin, by the way. On the fiction side of things, we review a notable pair of sequels, John Stevens' Fire Chronicle, which is the second title in his middle grade Books of Beginning series. The first, The Emerald Atlas, was released to critical acclaim last year, and the new book continues the adventures of siblings Kate, Michael, and Emma as they traverse time and the globe trying to stay ahead of the dark forces pursuing them. We also review Orson Scott Card's Ruins, which follows his 2010 science fiction novel Pathfinder. Coincidentally, there's also some major time bending going on in this book. Along with that Abe Lincoln picture book, we've got time travel options for any age reader in next week's issue. In children's, we also round up a group of design-focused books about animals and a few storybook treasuries featuring classics and contemporary stories alike.
And finally, Sam Slayton, there is a pick of the week this week, and let's hear about it.
For our pick of the week this week, we went with Chris Yuen's Safe House, a beautifully plotted thriller that offers as many twists and turns as motorcycle enthusiast Rob Hale encountered during the Isle of Man's annual Tourist Trophy time trial races. After a motorcycle accident catapults Rob into the hospital, he learns there's no evidence that Lena, the attractive blonde he'd just met who was riding on the back of his bike, ever existed. Determined to prove Lena wasn't a figment of his imagination, Rob teams with PI Rebecca Lewis in an investigation that becomes increasingly convoluted and dangerous.
Good to have you with us again this week. Sam Slayton, reviews editor at PW. Thank you very much for this week's review of reviews.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.